James comes onto the show every once in a while to talk to us about all things that are going on in the world, from the economy to Fukushima to what's happening in the Middle East and all of the other theaters that we are unaware of. And we are super appreciative because we always learn so much when he comes onto the program. So, James, thank you so much for once again joining us on the Power Hour today.
Well, thank you once again for a very nice introduction, JD. Always a pleasure to be talking to you.
Mr. Corbett, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello. Testing,
hello.
Testing.
Hello. Testing, testing.
Hey, John, I think we need some volume here.
Sorry, hello. I'm hello. Here. Honest, I'm here.
Awesome.
He's screaming. Uh-huh.
You can hear him all the way from Japan. James, before we get started today, I do want to pause for a minute and thank you just on air for taking the time away from your family to come and join us. I know that the time change is a big deal, and I wanted to wish you kind of a belated Happy Father's Day, since I know yesterday was Father's Day.
Well, thank you. That's extremely nice of you. And yes, it was a very nice Father's Day that I got to spend actually with my son. So what more could a father ask for?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, so let's get down to the brass tacks. The world's falling apart. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, well, that's always the question, isn't it? There's a million things mm-hmm. going on, so what do we want to concentrate mm-hmm. on? I think that what's happening in Iraq right now is extremely interesting for a lot of reasons. It looks like they're moving another piece on the geopolitical chessboard, and unfortunately, once again, it falls to us to document the flaws and problems with the propaganda that's coming out of this story. So I guess we could talk about that if you're interested.
I think that everybody is exceptionally interested, and we're all eager to hear your insight on ISIS and the origin of that crazy group and what is actually going on. Now, Joyce and I kind of have a theory that what's happening in Iraq right now is, an organic uprising. Part of this, they're sick of the occupation, part of this whole, organic, we're gonna finally fight back against occupiers. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think it's important to understand, as you say, where ISIS comes from, also known as ISIL, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, sometimes Islamic State in Iraq and al-Sham, Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, goes by some different names, but it was created in the early stages of the Iraq War. Immediately pledged its loyalty and fealty to al-Qaeda. So they're part of the big bad terror boogeyman umbrella group, I suppose. So that's kind of where its origins go back to. But it really started to come to prominence in Iraq later on, 2009, 2010, when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi took over the organization. So it's been growing in scope and prevalence in the last few years, especially kickstarted by the craziness in Syria, which of course is directly a NATO / GCC Gulf State operation. And we have to locate the growing power of this group and the growing ability of it to operate and do the types of things that it's doing right now, rolling along to Baghdad. That has to be seen in the wake of the hundreds of millions, presumably billions of dollars now that has been funneled in through Syria in all of the various operations that have been going on there for the last couple of years. And there's an excellent piece up on the New Eastern Outlook. It's at journal-neo.org by Tony Cartolucci, who people might know from Land Destroyer Report, that goes through this. It's called NATO's Terror Hordes in Iraq, A Pretext for Syria Invasion. And in that, he notes, I'll just read a couple of sentences here. ISIS is the product of a joint NATO-GCC conspiracy stretching back as far as 2007, where U.S.-Saudi policymakers sought to ignite a region-wide sectarian war to purge the Middle East of Iran's arch of influence stretching from its borders across Syria and Iraq and as far west as Lebanon and the coast of the Mediterranean. ISIS has been harbored, trained, armed, and extensively funded by a coalition of NATO and the Persian Gulf states within Turkey's borders, NATO territory, by the way, and has launched invasions into northern Syria with, at times, both Turkish artillery and air cover. So that's the real context that is, of course, not being reported to us right now. And we're being told that the CIA was taken completely by surprise when they started marching into Iraq and towards Baghdad. No one saw this coming, except, of course, the Lebanon Daily Star, which was actually covering back in March of this year. They had a story about ISIS leaving two of the provinces in Syria and heading eastward and towards Iraq, towards Raqqa province and the eastern outskirts of the northern city of Aleppo. So that was reported in the Daily Star, but apparently the CIA just couldn't possibly keep tabs on what was happening, and they had no idea this was coming.
They don't have a subscription to that publication.
Yeah.
What about I've been reading a lot about the Saudi Arabia connection with all of this. Like, this kind of is maybe spurred or nurtured on by Saudi Arabia. Is there a connection there?
There certainly is, because again, ISIS is one of these Wahhabist Sunni groups, which, of course, Wahhabism is a small splinter of Sunni Islam, but it has been harbored and really nursed into existence in Saudi Arabia and continues to be very much a Saudi influenced splinter of Islam, which is responsible for a lot of these terror organizations, Al Qaeda included. So the direct involvement of Saudi Arabia in Syria and the sending of Saudi jihadists into Syria is directly documentable, and again, not really a point of contention. It's been going on, in fact, not just from Saudi Arabia to Syria and then now into Iraq, but Saudi Arabia to Jordan and into Iraq as well. So we're seeing that absolutely, that Saudi has a large influence on this group and a lot of the groups that have been funneled into Syria. So there's definitely been a lot of U.S. Saudi collusion in this, and that should surprise absolutely no one. And again, if anyone's getting sort of echoes of Afghanistan and what happened there in the 1980s, I think that that's probably a pretty good way to look at this. Because again, mm-hmm. just like that, I mean, billions of dollars being funneled in through covert operations to fund the jihadists there in Afghanistan. But of course, that was all done for getting rid of those damn Ruskies. So I guess it was okay.
Yeah, I'm always. This reminds me of a quote by Babe Ruth where he said it's like deja vu all over again. You know what I mean? That's kind of how I feel. Okay, so when Joyce and I are having a lot of trouble getting our heads around the fact that Iraq supposedly has 800,000 to a million, you know, regular infantry people in their army, and ISIS, so far the numbers that we're seeing are fairly low, like 2,000. How is it that we're supposed to believe that the Iraqi troops are not able to handle such a small contingency? Is it just that they're so well armed or they're so well funded? You know, how is that? That just seems like such a disparity in terms of volume of numbers.
It really does, and it's made even more perplexing by the fact that there are now reports that 500 members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard have actually been sent into Iraq to help the Iraqi forces as well. I think Iran is officially denying that at this point, but that's what boots on the ground are saying at this point anyway. So again, even more of a number disparity there. And you're right. I mean, it is pretty bizarre. And from what I'm reading in all of the reports, they are putting it down to the sort of funding and the coordination of this group. And they do all have those brand new matching Toyotas, and you can see them in their little convoys.
They?
So there's definitely funding to this group. They definitely have access to arms and vehicles and all of this that's helping them to do this. And supposedly this is what's really making the difference in terms of their advancement and the fact that they're just so brutal, as we've been exposed to with all of these pictures of people being executed and things of that mm-hmm. sort.
You know what amazes me is that they could have become so strong in about 8 months' time, because they left and got a divorce from Al-Qaeda in late 2013, according to Wikipedia. They were so bad that Al-Qaeda kicked them out.
Yes.
I mean, they have gotten really good in just a few months, is all I can say, to be able to take over Tikrit, which is a town about the size of Kansas City. I mean, that would be hard to encircle Kansas City and to do it with, I mean, and they've done, now they've included the area the size of Indiana from Syria and Iraq. And I think it's just too convenient now that we might as well just go ahead and go after Iraq, Syria, and Iran at the same time. Do you have any concern that that might happen?
Yes. I mean, again, there's so many different strands to this story that we're being told right now. And yes, part of it was Zarqawi putting out a message last year, kicking them out from Al-Qaeda. So that's one of those strands. And then another one is apparently they're saying they're trying to pin the incredible funding that this group has on a bank robbery that they managed to do in Mosul that looted them $429 million. And they're supposedly saying this is where it's coming from. And now they're the best funded terror group in the world. So this is, I mean, again, there's so many different pieces to this story, and I don't know how this is meant to play out. I mean, I know that this is an operation that's being done with winks and nods, and there's certainly been a lot of Western involvement and Gulf state involvement in what's going on there, so I don't think we should take their surprise at face value, but I don't know what the next stage in this is, because now they're starting to talk about direct U.S.-Iranian cooperation in trying to work on the problem in Iraq. So again, I'm not sure which pieces on the puzzle of the puzzle they're trying to switch around and fit together now. So mm-hmm. I guess it's still very much in play.
I think the bottom line is they have a massive uprising on their hands. They don't know what to do about it. Now they've got to get the American people to believe that all these atrocities are taking place and all these people over there are just horrible, horrible. I mean, really bad guys, not bad guys, really bad guys. And we've got to stop it now, or else, like today they said, ISIS poses a threat to the United States security. They're upping the ante. We'll be back after this 4-minute break with the Power Hour. Stay tuned. James Corbett is our guest.
Welcome back to the Power Hour Radio Show. Ladies and gentlemen, it is 24 minutes past the hour. We are super fortunate speaking with Mr. James Corbett today. James, let's go ahead and kind of finish our discussion about Iraq. I want to know, in your opinion, we kind of already prefaced this by saying that we don't understand all the chess pieces that are in play right now, but if I had to pin you down and ask you to make a prediction, where do you think this whole situation is going to go in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to say is that this is going to put Iraq once again in the crosshairs. And again, I don't know how that's going to play out, but definitely there's going to be more attention towards Iraq, and also the possibility. I mean, I wouldn't expect anything of the sort of like boots on the ground or something coming from the U.S. or the Gulf states. But again, the idea of U.S. working with Iran or other groups working together that you wouldn't necessarily expect is a pretty interesting development. And ultimately, I think that something that's very likely to come of this is the splintering of Iraq, finally and officially. We've talked mm-hmm. about how the long-term plan in Iraq was always to divide it into three warring factions, and that was done fairly effectively. The Kurds, the Sunnis, and Shias in Iraq have been at each other's throats since the invasion, but I think that this might actually be the formal splitting of the country that we might be looking at, and again, we'll have to see how that plays out, but if it does, I mean, I think that's the real mission accomplished from 2003-2004. I think that's what they were aiming at in the first place, and I think if that happens, then the neocons basically get their wish.
You know, I'm glad you said since the invasion, because having talked with people from over there who said that the Sunnis and Shias lived together, had no problem with each other until the United States came in there. And then, of course, they started bombing the Shia this and the Shiite that, and then all the people were upset and they pitted one against the other. So I'm glad you said that it was only since, the invasion of Iraq. I'm concerned about Russia, you know, the lack of any information coming from Russia on all of this.
Well, there has been a little bit. We had Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov come out and said that the Iraq war had been a total failure, so that it was pretty much inevitable that this was going to happen. He said we are greatly alarmed by what is happening in Iraq. We warned long ago that the affair that the Americans and the Britons stirred up there wouldn't end well. So they've made an official kind of pronouncement on this at this point, basically. And there's a very, very bizarre and interesting story up on the Washington Post about this in the Washington Post blog section. It's called Russia on Iraq, We Told You So. And if people get the chance, they should go and read this story, because it's written in a very strange manner, talking about how, oh, you know, those Russians saying we told you so on this. But, you know, they might actually have a point. But of course, they're just saying this because they want to score political points against the U.S. But, you know, it turns out they're actually kind of right. It's written in a very strange way. But of course, just underlying that new Cold War type rhetoric that we've seen coming out of the establishment media for the last several months.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to recommend everybody goes over to thecorbettreport.com to find out what's going on in James's world, the economy and all these other things. But there's another site that you've got called Fukushima Update, which I also find myself going to all the time, trying to figure out what is going on with the Fukushima situation. So what's happening in that arena? What are the new developments? What do we know for sure right now?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency here, the NRA, the JNRA, to differentiate it from the American version, gave the go-ahead to TEPCO to start the so-called ice wall, to start putting up this ice wall around the four reactors that is supposedly going to prevent groundwater from flooding into the site and going through the site and becoming radioactive by being contaminated at the site. So basically, for those who don't know, what they're going to attempt to do is construct an ice wall underground that will freeze the earth around the plant so that the groundwater won't be able to flow through that section.
Doesn't that just sound like the silliest idea? I mean, is that not the most just out there ridiculous plan? I mean, they couldn't come up with anything sillier, really? I mean,
yeah. Well, let's just read a little bit. So this is from straight.com. It's posted up on Fukushima Update. It says the ice wall project involves sinking tubes carrying coolant 1 meter apart up to 30 meters underground in a roughly 1.5 kilometer rectangular shape around the four reactors. The piped refrigerant at minus 30 degrees Celsius, I have no idea what that is in Fahrenheit, sorry, would freeze groundwater and create an impervious 2 meter thick soil wall. So a lot of metric measurements there, but I think you get the idea. And yes, I mean, basically the idea is that they're going to be able to maintain this ice wall for what? A century, a couple centuries, a couple millennia. I mean, how long is this? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is pretty ridiculous. And given that they couldn't even get the reactors to work properly, I'm pretty sure that this isn't going to work properly either.
We'll be back after this 3 minute break. Stay tuned to the Power Hour, CorbettReport.com. Stay tuned. Anyway, moving back to the subject today, we're talking to James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. And if you go to his website, CorbettReport.com with two T's, you can look at the interview with Joanne and James Moriarty. He did a really excellent interview regarding and also with Faraj Mufta that was on there. So you can go to CorbettReport.com right on the front page there. It'll show you how to get to the interview that he did with the Moriartys. Also, you can now donate Bitcoin to James Corbett. That's right. If you want to help out the Corbett Report, donate to his website, and or you can donate Bitcoin and sign up for his newsletter at CorbettReport.com. James, I just got to ask you, hey, how about that stock market? Not bad, huh?
Hey, it's doing great. I think this is the time to pile on in. Yes, it is. It is pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing to watch, and it's amazing to watch some of the rhetoric that comes out when people talk about these markets as if we, again, have reached some kind of new normal. This is the new economy. So look at this. Everything's up, but not only up, it's up much further than we ever thought was going to happen. And of course, at the beginning of the year, people were thinking, you know, this is going to be, there's definitely going to be a decline. Well, you know, we saw a bit of a decline on the Dow Jones today, but not very much. And we've seen record after record being set by the S&P and the Dow Jones in recent weeks. So it's just one of those things that just defies explanation unless you look at the root cause of what's happening in the American economy with QE3 and the continuing pumping of tens of billions of dollars into the banks, basically to capitalize their and take their toxic assets off of their books. And once again, we see bank holdings and bank loans continuing to skyrocket. Bank profits continuing to skyrocket, even as loans don't actually aren't actually increasing that much. So every metric that you look at shows the disconnect between what's happening in the equities markets and what's happening in the economy. But it certainly is something to behold as we continue on this rocket ride up to the heavens with the S&P and the Dow Jones.
And of course, you've got the commodities moving up today, and gold, you know, they throw a little bit of chum in the water every once in a while and let us think that it's actually going somewhere when it really doesn't go anywhere. It just stays the same. Is up where I guess it was around 1280, 1290 today. And then you've got, of course, oil going up because that's real handy, you know, scare everybody about the lack of oil and then the price goes up. So things are just kind of moving in the direction that they want it to go, it appears.
No, that's exactly right. It continues to move along in that direction. But as we've talked about many times, it really is the question of when the music stops playing on this game of musical chairs. And again, that's really just a calculation that's going to be reached probably through geopolitical machinations. Again, this will, when this happens and when we start to see the piper starts to want to be paid, I think we're going to see the geopolitical ramifications of all of this. And that's when, you know, that, I mean, that's obviously the most worrying time of destabilization and when we would look for some sort of war to take place. I mean, that's mm-hmm. exactly what the conditions that really led to World War One and World War Two. And unfortunately, we're sitting on a very similar in a very similar terrain right now. And I don't want to put it in an alarming way, but I think it's realistic to take a look at the ways that this could shape into some sort of total war that might be used as the excuse for whatever economic collapse is coming.
You know, I want to kind of brag on you just a little bit. You did a really incredible video on RT that's available on your website. It's about a 5-minute, 40-second interview in which RT in the Now interviewed you. Excellent job. Well, let me ask you what your thoughts are. Well, first of all, when they called you, what did they want you to talk about? Did they tell you what they want you to say, or did they ask you what you wanted to say?
No, I was just told that they wanted to talk about the recent Asia Defense Forum and some of the comments that had been made there by the U.S. and whether this was kind of a militarization, move to militarization in the Asia Pacific.
And do they give you any, I mean, do they tell you keep your, I mean, do they give you any coaching when you come on the air?
Absolutely not. I've never been told what to say or how to say it. And in fact, I didn't even have any clue how long that segment was going to be when they were asking me the questions. So I had no idea if I was going overtime or not, but it seemed to work out.
Of course, they can always cut it out whenever they want to do if it's not a live interview. But I guess it is live on that one. Your thoughts on what's happening with China now?
I mean, when we look at it militarily, it's hard to look at this in any other way than the sense that China is being encircled militarily. I mean, if we're going to look at it from the perspective of just the military engagements and the naval agreements that are being reached in the region right now, it would be almost impossible to look at it in any other light. And I will direct the listeners over to the blog of my friend and partner, Brock West of Asia Pacific Perspective. We do a monthly video series on these types of issues, and he just posted up there on apperspective.net today the U.S.-Australia military alliance against China, talking about Tony Abbott and Barack Obama's recent conference, hubbub, whatever you want to call it, where Abbott wants to assure the president that Australia will be an utterly dependable ally of the United States. Again, with the unspoken assumption of this, again, that this is being directed towards China, because once again, I mean, it was actually made explicit for the first time in the Asia Defense Forum recently that took place in Singapore, where Secretary of Defense Hagel came out and explicitly stated that China is a destabilizing presence in the region and something that will be a threat to security. So it's starting to become quite out in the open. And when you look at just all of the different commitments and agreements that have been signed in recent months and years, there's no question that there is a considerable amount of firepower that is now pointing directly at China. And China is no angel in all of this either. I mean, I would say that some of their actions, especially in the South China Sea, have been just completely menacing. And I think that plays into the situation as well. And of course, we have to look at what happened recently with Vietnam in that regard. And the placing of the oil rig in that disputed territory is a pretty bold move. And one of those moves that's attempted attempting to create kind of a reality on the ground that can only be dissuaded by some sort of military action. So again, there's a lot of brinksmanship happening on both sides. And again, I think that plays politically into the bases of all of the people involved in this, in these conflicts, and economically, of course, it, as always, continues to line the pockets of the fat cats in the military industrial complex.
Let's open up the phone lines. If you would like to talk to our guest today, James Corbett, the phone number is 855-995-6923, 855-995-6923. If you have a question or comment for James Corbett today. Bitcoin seems to be doing fairly well now. You've decided to go ahead and take it as a donation. Are you concerned? Do you have any concerns about the long-term use of Bitcoin or the government's control of Bitcoin?
To be clear, I've been accepting Bitcoin for a couple of years now. I guess the donate Bitcoin button wasn't quite as prominent earlier, but I've been accepting it for a while. Yeah. So
I did not realize that.
Yes. So in the time that I've been accepting it, I've gotten, I think, almost 4 Bitcoin now, almost up to 4. And most of that was back when it was down at, you know, $50 or something more like that, rather than 600, which it is now. So again, with Bitcoin, for me personally, I have not personally spent a single Bitcoin or even a fraction of a Bitcoin anywhere. So I have all of the Bitcoin I've ever been donated or has ever been sent to me. And for myself, I really do just see it as something that I'm just holding and seeing how it will interface with my life. I mean, even from a very practical perspective, it's very difficult for me to actually use these Bitcoin right now, even here in Japan, which everyone thinks is the cutting edge of technology. But I have, for example, I'm not proud of this fact at all. In fact, I just wrote an editorial about this for the International Forecaster. But I have an iPhone, which up until very recently had actually banned Bitcoin wallets from their app store. So unless you jailbreak your iPhone, there's no way for you to actually exchange Bitcoin through an app on your phone. You have to do it via web connection. So it has been very inconvenient and continues to be. And that's really, I think, the fundamental thing that you're driving at with that question is, I mean, they can't really suppress Bitcoin itself. It is a decentralized technology. Even if you shut down the internet, it could theoretically be done on paper with pencils and, you know, copying down hashes and things. I mean, obviously, it wouldn't happen that way. But I mean, it's an idea that can't actually be stopped. But having said that, of course, it's the connections between Bitcoin and the real economy is the pressure points. And we've seen all sorts of regulations. I mean, the IRS declaring it as a type of property, so you have to declare a capital gains on every single Bitcoin transaction. I mean, these types of things can be the regulation that basically stop it ever being widely adopted. And again, those types of regulations, I suppose, are only as good as self-reporting, because Bitcoin, if not completely anonymous, can at least be pseudonymous and can be more or less difficult to track. And we can presume at this point, at any rate, the IRS probably isn't putting in, you know, millions of dollars and man hours into tracking down every Bitcoin transaction. But having said that, I mean, again, I do see some incredible blocks in the road for this becoming a widely used currency. And I thought that one of the most interesting takes I've read about this in recent months was a post. I wish I could find it again, because I'd love to be able to direct people to it. But I read a post from someone basically saying that Bitcoin's big problem is that they talk about it as a currency. And of course, that puts it in that realm of currency that's going to be in some way, I mean, governments are going to be interested in it. They're going to want to regulate it. We have central banks all over the world coming out with different policy papers on Bitcoin and what it means. But this paper that I was reading said, well, Bitcoin really should have just phrased itself as this is just some sort of tech transaction that's taking place. All it is bits and bytes. All it is sending someone some bits and bytes over the internet that says that they have, you know, this hash in their wallet or whatever, this hashtag number. And that's all it is, really. I mean, the fact that they frame it as a currency is the reason that it gets all of this attention. But if they simply phrased it as that, they could have probably gone under the radar in terms of government regulation for a lot longer than they did.
Wow, that is an important lesson.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, Bitcoin is like the canary in the coal mine for this whole decentralized dollar issue. You know, a lot of people don't really understand that, that the dollars that we use, unless you're actually trading in cash, there's really not a lot of difference between those and a cryptocurrency because, you know, 99% of it exists in computers. And it's, you know, we're already kind of in that realm anyway. But, you know, I look at things like Iceland, you know, that has basically taken their national currency and created a Bitcoin that is independent to their country and that really ties together the idea of value and the Bitcoin.
And that immediately crashed, by the way.
Oh, did it really?
It did. They launched it and they did an airdrop, quote unquote. So they gave every Icelander a certain number of these coins to launch it. Mm-hmm. And at the start, I can't remember what it was at, $20, $100, whatever it was. It seemed promising, but it was literally destroyed in about a week or something like that. And that was because the network was just too small, so it was prone to some basic attacks. It was very easily attacked and successfully. So Bitcoin, very, very much harder to attack in those types of ways because it's a much, much larger network with a lot more users. But interestingly, I don't know a lot of the details on this. I haven't been following it so carefully, but apparently something like there is some sort of problem in terms of the way that Bitcoin are mined. Apparently the largest Bitcoin mining operation, it mines over 51% of the Bitcoin, which means mm-hmm. that they now hold a dangerous percentage, which could allow them to more easily commit attacks on the Bitcoin network. So now this is becoming an issue, and you see Bitcoiners trying to rally around, trying to support some of the other mining operations so that this one doesn't take over, you know, basically Bitcoin and potentially crash the entire currency. So there are technical problems that still are sorting themselves out. And of course, now that this is millions of dollars in notional value of this Bitcoin's floating around, there's a lot more interest in trying to crash the network and things like this. So it's an experiment in a lot of different ways. And it's kind of interesting from that perspective. But yes, I mean, I don't think this is going to be replacing any currencies anytime soon. As an alternative that allows for electronic transaction over the internet, I think it's a promising experiment. But other than that, I wouldn't be putting a lot of faith in this as being some sort of replacement for currency as we know it.
I guess for me, it's just the excitement of the idea that you can step away from the central bank, I guess, to me is something that just, it's got to be done. You know, we've got to make strides to make this stuff work. I'm not sure if, as I say, Bitcoin is going to be the long-term solution, but it's interesting that you are accepting Bitcoin. And I personally, if I had a service to offer, I'd be accepting Bitcoin also at this point.
Is the paperwork, though, is it make it almost impossible to justify doing it, especially, I mean, is there a limit to how much, or is there a ceiling when you must begin reporting Bitcoin, or how does that work, James?
You know, honestly, I've read some different takes on that from different people claiming to be, you know, tax lawyers and things of that sort. And so I will leave it up to the people out there to sort out which advice they're going to listen to. There are some mm-hmm. people who I think are just ignoring that completely when it comes to the U.S. government. But again, it's different in every country around the world. And of course, here I am in Japan, and the Japanese government has no such official ruling at this point. So,
interesting.
Again, yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll be back after this 3-minute break. Final segment with our guest today, James Corbett. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Joyce.
And JD. Welcome back to the Power Hour Radio Show, ladies and gentlemen. 54 minutes past the hour, finishing up our second hour of the broadcast today, and we're joined by Mr. James Corbett, talking about all kinds of things, Fukushima, Bitcoin, economy, what's going on in Iraq, all kinds of stuff. But we also have the phone lines open, so if you'd like to call in if you have a question for Mr. James Corbett, you can reach us at 855-995-6923. Again, that number is...
The phone lines aren't working. They got to reset them. They're not working. So...
Okay, sorry about that.
So don't get frustrated doing that.
Roger that. Okay, James, while we were on the subject of the Bitcoin and the financial stuff, I want to talk to you a little bit about just generally speaking the strength of the dollar around the world. We're hearing a lot about the BRICS, you know, coming up with their own central bank. We've got all kinds of deals between China and Russia going on right now that looks like they're stepping away from the dollar. What are you hearing on your side of the world, and what are your thoughts on the continuing strength or the continuing demise of the dollar?
Well, I do see the downward trend, the trajectory that we've noted for a while here on the program, and we've been charting various things. And as it turns out, the China-Russia gas deal that we talked about, the $400 billion gas deal over the next 25 years, that apparently is going to be denominated in dollars. So that that actually didn't end up being the type of game-changing deal that we thought. But that's because a lot of the financial infrastructure for export deals specifically are still denominated in dollars between most countries on the planet. They're actually now working to set up the financial infrastructure for doing those types of transactions in local currencies in the future. So there was recently a deal that China made with Russia's second largest bank towards that end. So we'll see how that affects in the future. But again, I think the overall trend with a lot of these bilateral trade deals that China's conducting is towards more local currency transactions rather than settling in U.S. dollars. And again, it's the death of a thousand paper cuts. But I think the real action in this particular game is going to be happening probably in Saudi Arabia. And I'm very interested to keep my eye on what's happening between China and Saudi Arabia as their relationship begins to develop. They've in recent months started holding more talks, basically moving towards creating a closer tie, which tracks along with the Saudis backing away from the U.S., which of course they've been very much in the U.S. fold under the U.S. military umbrella since Kissinger started the petrodollar regime back in the 1970s. And this is a pretty significant change that's taking place right now as Saudi Arabia becomes more and more vocal about the fact that they're unhappy with the United States and its, for example, lack of interest in bombing Syria to smithereens, or supposed lack of interest. So and coupled that with the fact that China just recently became the largest oil importer in the world, overtaking the U.S., I think the Saudis are really starting to think about distancing from the U.S. and move towards China. And if that process really starts to solidify, and if we see the Saudis really starting to move towards the BRICS bloc, then I think you have a pretty significant challenge to the dollar starting to develop. And again, it's at that point that you'd have to start to wonder if there would be some sort of military aggression taking place as a result, not necessarily on the table or above board because of those types of transactions. Of course, there would be some sort of other, I mean, maybe suddenly it would be discovered, oh, wow, look, ISIS is actually being funded by the Saudis. Now we have to go after Saudi Arabia. Maybe that kind of revelation would happen. But at some point, I think if there was a significant challenge, we would see some sort of military confrontation as a result.
Well, that's a big statement, though, because I think that there's a heck of a precedent that's been set for us being allies with Saudi Arabia. I think there would have to be quite an event to make us look at them as opponents. I can't even imagine what would have to transpire for that to happen.
Let's go to we got the phones working now. Let's go to Dave in New York. Dave, you're on the air. Go ahead, please, with James Corbett.
Good morning.
Morning.
Just an observation. With the breakaway, we're coming up to a break right now.
Yep, we got to take a minute and 10-second break. You want to hold on, we will hold you over. Minute and 10-second break with James Corbett at the Power Hour today. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Power Hour, ladies and gentlemen. It is straight up top of the hour. We are speaking today with Mr. James Corbett. And Dave in New York, you were on the air. Go ahead, please, with your question for Mr. James Corbett.
Yeah, James. With the creation of the most fierce al-Qaeda yet, the ISIS, that's what ISIS, is that what the acronym is?
Yes, that's right.
A nice American acronym, which I think is really clever of them to do that.
Yeah, it's sort of like Bill Clinton when he said it depends on what is. But anyway, I would expect to see the white al-Qaeda show up here because they're probably going to be the nastiest ones. That reporter or journalist from Syria that was on with Moriarty said that they're from all over the world, Ireland, Australia, you name it, and Al-Qaeda is it now. So I kind of thought they'd have a breakaway. You know, the really bad guys are going to be the white ones, and they're going to, of course, be Republicans, too, you know, in the back burner. Anyway, just a thought.
Well, you know, actually, on that note, people probably should take a look at Matthew Van Dyke, one of those white Al-Qaeda or whatever, Al-Qaeda fighters in Syria, who went in to support the resistance that's taking place in Syria and all of the propaganda. An interesting character in a lot of ways, and he's up on Twitter and he has his own website and everything. But there was an excellent podcast about Matthew Van Dyke on the Porkins Policy Review podcast. So just type that into a search engine and I'm sure you'll be able to find it. He did a great breakdown of this Van Dyke character and what's really behind him and how he manages to go across borders and do these incredible things. Seemingly without any retribution or any, just, you know, breezing through borders and across countries. And so it's there's definitely something in there with these resistance fighters from various countries who somehow end up in the midst of these things. So I think there is a developing narrative that they're going to spring on us at some point with regards to these types of people.
All right. Good question, Dave. Thank you for that. Let's go to Shane in North Carolina. Shane, you are on the air with James Corbett. Go ahead, please.
Hey guys, what's up, James? Hey man, I absolutely had to call in because I've been a big fan of your work for a long time. So I thought, man, I just gotta say great work, you know. And one of the things that I did want to mention though was that, you know, with all this talk about currencies and all the volatility of the world right now, you know, just about to erupt or erupting basically. one thing I was curious about is if you think that the patriot demonization in the United States is, of course, off the hook right now. I'm sure you might be paying attention to some of these recent shooting false flags where it's just ridiculous, these characters that they invent. And, you know, I mean, even covering up, you know, the victims with Gadsden flags and stuff. I mean, it's just outrageous. But I kind of wonder about a financial crash and if they're going to try to blame patriots and Bitcoin and silver and gold and if they're going to try to, you know, blame patriots for some of the problems that happen financially. And one other thing I wanted to ask you is that because of some of the company that you keep, some of the shows I hear you on, like Dr. Stan and whatnot, I was also curious if you have any biblical or spiritual kind of tie-ins with all this the stuff that we're talking about today.
Okay, Shane, good question. Go ahead, James.
Absolutely. Well, that is a good question. I don't really get into the religious side of it because I don't claim to be any type of religious or spiritual leader, and I wouldn't expect people to come to me for that type of information. I certainly am not a materialist. I think there is more to this universe than what can be weighed or measured or put in a test tube, but I don't claim to have any special access or understanding of that. I come from a Christian background. My parents were Christian and brought me up in the Christian church. I'm not a practicing member of the Christian church at this point, but I certainly do have an understanding that there is spirituality in this world, and I think we all have to come to our own understanding of that. So I don't claim to tell people what to think on those matters. With regards to the idea of some sort of patriot false flag, when it comes to currencies and things of that sort, I mean, it's certainly possible. I think it's more likely they'll try to blame that on some sort of geopolitical thing, but it's certainly possible that at some point they're going to turn the guns and all of this like against the patriot movement. So something to keep our eye on.
Very good. James, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, James. Thanks.